only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And good morning, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD Public Radio, serving Kenosha, Racine, and Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm very pleased to have as my guest our state school superintendent, Dr. Tony Evers, who's been a guest before here on Education Matters. Dr. Evers, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity.
Before we get into a number of issues, you grew up in Plymouth, Wisconsin. You graduated from Plymouth High School. As you look back at your years there at the high school, was there one particular teacher who stands out in your mind as someone who really made a difference in your life, educationally or otherwise?
There was many, actually, but I'll just mention one in particular. His name is Dale Paskey, and Dale passed away several years ago. But what made him special, he was a U.S. history teacher, so it's, you know, all about facts and figures, but and remembering dates and so on. But he always had us think about history as a historian does. We would maybe study some fact or figure or battle or something, but at the end of the day, when he kind of got through that, he said, now, let's look at how another historian looked at that very same issue or topic or battle. And it was just amazing to me as a student that kind of the same kind of dry picture of something in the past actually came to life because a different historian looked at it completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had us look at history as a historian did. And I thought that was a really good learning experience for me.
Well, you know, that's a great lead-in as far as my first question. And we'll talk about, you know, the agenda for the next 4 years as mm-hmm. A state superintendent. You were just reelected, of course, in April, and your third election, first elected in 2009, then in 2013. But the first question is, I'll refer to an article that was in Education Week a few days ago, and it was written by Jill Berkowitz and Ann Myers, actually on their blog on leadership, and I had both Jill and Ann as my guests before. And the headline is, Betsy DeVos, who's our U.S. Department of Education Secretary, it says, Betsy DeVos is just plain wrong. And it starts out by saying, Betsy DeVos is attempting to reverse the federal position on civil rights by allowing states to decide whether private schools can accept federal dollars and discriminate against any students for any reason. So my question for you is, as we look at the new administration in Washington, and I could say, you know, we're not going to get into political stuff, but as you and I both know, everything is political nowadays.
Sure.
I don't care what anyone says. But how do you see all this impacting Wisconsin and the country in terms of the president's agenda, and in particular Betsy DeVos's agenda?
That's a great question.
How's that for a lead-in?
Yeah, how about that for a lead-in? Well, first of all, I'm disappointed in your entire agenda, and I can work from the president to Secretary DeVos, but starting out with the president, clearly his budget has been, it's around things that, frankly, I think are going to be very hurtful. Now, I'll just start off by saying everybody says, well, that's never going to happen. The president never gets everything he wants, whatever. And Congress will take care of it, you know, because he's cutting anything from K teacher professional development money, where it's in Wisconsin, that federal money covers almost 100% of every district's professional development, almost every district, and almost 100%.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge deal. And then cutting completely the money for after-school programming, public radio, public TV, public libraries. So clearly there's a pattern there, right? And you know, when I get excited about it, people say, well, Congress will take care of it. But frankly, this is the first public policy statement this president has had the opportunity to make about public education. And basically his message is, got it, especially these programs that he views as not important, like professional development, and also, you know, Advantage, more money for voucher schools state mm-hmm. or across the country. Questionable place to start in my mind. And then Secretary DeVos is, you know, her mantra is around vouchers, and she said some quite extraordinary things about states' rights as it relates to individual freedoms and protections that all kids should have. And that's troubling. I mean, I know her ability to mandate things that she talks about is probably somewhat limited, but the fact of the matter is that's her bully pulpit. And, you know, I had a chance to be with her a couple times, and she clearly, her focus is around choice and in particular vouchers, and
mm-hmm.
and that they, and when she says that we have to give kids an option from the one size fits all public schools, I just want to scream.
Mm.
I mean, you tell me what public school is one size fits all. If you look at Milwaukee or Salem that you know of, they're doing all sorts of things to meet individual student needs. So that kind of mantra, frankly, sickens me. And so I'm disappointed in that direction. But, you know, we have to place, I guess, our trust in our Congress people to modify that behavior. But it's a bad starting place. And I'm not quite sure, frankly, see where it's going to end up as it relates to vouchers, because we certainly have a robust system of vouchers in
mm-hmm.
our state, so I'm not sure how taking Title I money to turn on the spigot there when the spigot's already on in Wisconsin. I'm not quite sure how that plays
mm-hmm.
out. I don't think it's going to be helpful, because that would mean Title I money that we would normally get goes elsewhere.
Obviously, here in Wisconsin, we have as you just stated, a robust voucher system, and certainly the voucher system in Milwaukee, which is very similar with the one that they have in Cleveland, is well known nationally and has been for many, many years, and it's something that Robin Voss is very supportive of. And
mm-hmm.
and Robin, as you look at the next 4 years of this current term that you were just elected to, do you see any changes in how the state is going to be dealing with school vouchers?
Well, I can only speak from kind of afar on this issue, because
mm-hmm.
A lot of it is determined by the legislature.
Right.
And I have to believe over the next 4 years we'll see a movement to increase the number of out-state vouchers that has been. I mean, I would say that you can say whatever you want about the majority party, but they've been very transparent on this issue, including Representative Voss and the governor. And their goal is to have a robust, even more robust statewide presence for vouchers. And so it may not happen this time, although I suspect that there will be some last-minute push on that. But eventually that will be the battle. And, you know, my position is we have to make sure that our public schools, which are kind of our constitutional linchpin and our linchpin of democracy, is adequately funded, and not at the expense, the voucher expansion shouldn't be taking away money from our public schools.
Mm-hmm. As you look at the next 4 years, what are a few of the of the major agenda items educationally that that you have at the top of your list?
Sure. I will continue to fight for more equity in our public school system, period, but especially as it relates to finances. I don't think there's anybody that would argue that children that struggle the most or come from the most disadvantaged backgrounds should and likely will need more resources and therefore will need more help and then as a result need more resources financially. And that isn't the case. Right now we're pretty much focused on giving everybody the same amount, and I just don't think that's where we want to be as a state. So that's kind of a long-term thing. But immediately, I'm very hopeful that this next budget will help us focus on mental health in the state of Wisconsin with our children. 1 in 5 suffer from mental health issues, and our ability to deal with those issues and other kind of social and emotional learning issues are really an important precursor to kids achieving at high levels. And so I'm real interested in having us focus as a state on that, and I think we'll actually be getting some money in this next budget to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. When we look at the graduation rate in the state, about 93% of white students graduate. Our African American graduation rate is at about 64%. I know that one of the things that that you have talked about, and not just during the political campaign, but it's something that you've talked about, is this idea of every child a graduate, college and career ready. How does all that fit together when we look at the graduation rate of all students in the state, and then when we start to focus in particular, with the African American graduation rate?
Yeah, there's no question, and I have been talking about that. And we're making some slight headways, but we've got a long way to go. If you're an African-American kid in Wisconsin and you're from an affluent family, you will likely achieve at a lower level than a white kid that is from an impoverished family.
Mm-hmm.
So race is an issue in this state, and, you know, people get kind of crazy when people talk about Black Lives Matter and all what that all entails. And what that entails in my book is that we have to make sure that the people that work with our kids, especially kids of color, are culturally competent, understand the different cultures that are in their classroom. And frankly, our teachers need time in order to establish really robust and meaningful relationships with kids that may look different than they do, and also their families. You know, I was just at a visiting a school yesterday where it is high achieving school. Kids of poverty. I mean, there isn't any kid that's not struggling in this area where I'm at that isn't succeeding. But they all, you know, they're all kids of color. They're all impoverished kids, and they're doing well. One of the reasons is, A, the teachers understand the cultural milieu of where those kids come from, but B, also have the time to spend establishing relationships with those children. And small example, this one school I was visiting, they spend the first 3 days of the school year, you know, camping with kids,
mm-hmm.
touring urban areas with these kids. Essentially, it's 3 full days of being with their students outside of the school day, and creating those bonds that they're going to need for the rest of the school year. So that's the kind of thoughtful processes that we have to consider to make changes. It's not necessarily going to happen overnight. It's going to have to change some people's worldview. Another thing, and this isn't probably as meaningful as the stuff I just talked about, but we need to think about time as a factor. You know, clearly more time is important, and summer is a time that, frankly, many districts, especially urban districts, have trouble getting kids involved with catching up. And so frankly, I'd love to see year-round school at some point. I know that's heresy in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
I think, but time does matter. And I think that extra time also will allow teachers to build those strong bonds with kids.
I know since you brought that up, I know one of the things that that you have talked about is, in particular with Milwaukee Public Schools, is to have their academic year start before Labor Day. What's the status of that? Is there any possibility that that can actually happen?
Well, we're actually having that happen in some of the high schools because of my authority under underperforming schools.
Mm-hmm.
So that is happening in some of the high schools. I would love to have it happen within the entire district.
Sure.
Dr. Driver is an extraordinary superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
She understands that, time does matter. And I think there's a possibility that might happen in Milwaukee. It's not in the budget, but I hear enough legislative buzz around it that I'm hopeful that it will reappear in the budget.
Mm-hmm. As you know, I teach at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh in the Educational mm-hmm. Leadership Program, and UW Oshkosh certainly attempts to attract students of color. We are certainly not as diverse as UW-Milwaukee, but as we look at the research that looks at African-American teachers and the impact they have on African-American students or Hispanic teachers on Hispanic students, and the program they have at Clemson University that's called Call Me Mister, as we look at the impact of teachers and the impact that the individual teachers have on students, how can we better ensure that every student will have highly effective teachers? And I've always believed that we have incredible education here in Wisconsin. Yeah. We always have, and we still do. But how can we make it even better?
Yeah, that's a great point. And see, I know there are some, it might be UWM, somebody is starting a Call Me Mr. program
mm-hmm.
in the system. I can't remember where it is,
mm-hmm.
but it is going to exist. And I also have to add to your comment, I think it's incredibly important to diversify our workforce. And we're working with states from around the country on that very issue as we speak. But it's also incredibly important that our majority of kids have exposure to teachers of color, too. I mean, there's pretty good research around that increasing not only awareness of different cultures, but actually helps them achieve at higher levels. So diversifying the workforce will be good for all kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing we have to do, frankly, is, our state and the country as a whole, but our state in particular, has been as you see at UW Oshkosh, I'm sure, and other campuses around the system, a genuine and alarming decline in the number of young people that are expressing interest in becoming teachers. And for the most part, that's an issue of demonizing the profession for all sorts of reasons. You know, we can go to the Act 10 piece, and I understand people don't like to talk about that, but that was part of it. And but the profession itself has undergone some significant stress in the way people dialogue around a teaching profession. So we can clean that up, and that's free. We just have to start understanding the importance of teachers to the to our kids' future and to our democracy's future.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so we have to reinvigorate the pipeline. But I also think that we need to, and we struggle with this all the time because we get more and more requirements for higher education to do X, Y, and Z in teacher preparation. But the sooner we get kids out of the classroom, the better. I think there's great research around residencies where they spend a full year in a school district. And so the more hands-on experience people can have up front, that's important. But in addition, we have to increase the pipeline and some things I talked about we can do. But in addition, we're looking to kind of reinvigorate this pipeline at the high school level, getting kids involved with possibly used to be called Future Teachers of America. Now we call it Educators Rising. And
right,
really,
that's part of Phi Delta Kappa now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I think there's ways to do that.
Mm-hmm.
While we do that, we have to also guard against the kind of the insidious dumbing down of the profession that some politicians like to talk about from time to time. We need to make sure that we have good, high-quality people in the classroom, but that does not mean that we should be dumbing down
mm-hmm.
the profession.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Act 10. If you had to name one positive thing and one negative thing at the top of the list for each for Act 10, what might they be?
It's hard for me to articulate a real positive stuff because I was against it. I felt that there are other ways to deal with the issues of teachers paying more for their health insurance mm-hmm. and paying more for their retirement. I mean, that was kind of a smokescreen since we get rid of teacher unions. So let me go negative first. I think as a result of Act 10, teachers' voice has been stifled, and I'm not blaming this on school boards or administrators, but it just the entire battle over that just made teachers kind of retreat from being leaders and expressing voice. And I think we have to kind of rebuild that. We're starting with some teachers as leaders programming at the state level. It did bail out the system as far as money goes for a short period of time. It was a one-year fix in that school budgets were kind of held stable, but it was held stable. Okay, so that's a good thing, I guess. The bad thing is it was held stable because it took money to do that. It took money out of teachers and paraprofessionals and custodians and other state workers' pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only go to that well so many times before it becomes hurtful. So was there a short-term stabilization of funding at the state level that they could say we kept funding the same during very difficult economic times? Yes. But that look where that money came from, and that came from teachers' pockets.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned before, I'm a school board member in Salem mm-hmm. in Western Kenosha County, and oftentimes I'm asked by many people, how should we pay for students' education? I know that in a news release that you put out on May 18th, you urged Congress as far as the budget goes, in rejecting cuts to the education budget. What's the status of funding for education in Wisconsin, and what impact do you think your call and perhaps other state school superintendents' calls for, not cutting the education budget will have?
Yeah, and I'll start with the federal level. I do believe that Congress, for various reasons, but one is because it's such a slow, drawn-out process that allows, frankly, more engagement. But I think they will reject President Trump's budget. And so I don't anticipate increases, but I don't anticipate decreases. My first comments were real negative about the president's budget, but I think people need to call him out on it regardless of what Congress does.
Mm-hmm.
At a state level, there seems to be a good effort around increasing funding, and I think school districts will see increased funding. It gets us back to where we were several years ago. And I'll tell you, Steve, part of the issue is, I think people genuinely want to support public schools, but they do because they see, 60, 70, 80% of the referenda being passed. I mean, almost a million people over the last three general elections voted to increase taxes on themselves through referenda. That gets first of all, that's not sustainable. We can't expect local people to cover that much of the funding of schools. But it catches politicians' eyes when a million people are voting to support their public schools. And that's the main reason why we'll see an increase this time around. Now, will that be a sustained effort that, you know, kind of getting us back to where we were several years ago? Yes, it's good to get back to that point, but the kind of proof will be in the pudding the next biennium after that.
Mm-hmm. And my last question for you, obviously with the changes in the administration and in Washington and the issue of the rights of the LGBTQ community and transgender students, how can we ensure that we have safe schools for all students here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and that's a real troubling issue for me, not only just from the federal level, but there seems to be some efforts on the part of some legislators to occasionally propose legislation that will clearly harm especially transgender kids.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of trample on their rights. And I'm fearful that if it caught some headwind behind it, that those would pass. That would be a bad deal. I've been relatively pleased with school districts' response to that. I think for the most part, school board members, when faced with that issue, have dealt with it in a real kind of reasoned and actually a scholarly way. And so But I think it's at some point in time we'll need some help legislatively to protect kids' rights instead of taking kids' rights away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really want to thank you, Tony, for taking your time. I know this was a busy day for you as far as your schedule, and hopefully we can have you on again here on Education Matters.
Yeah, thanks, Steve, and thanks for your service. I appreciate it.
And you're listening to Education Matters here on WGTD HD. And we continue now with our second segment, which was previously aired. I'm very pleased to welcome into this segment of Education Matters here on WGTD Public Radio my very special guest and good friend Paul Peterson. And if that name is familiar to you, it should be. Paul was one of the stars on the great Donna Reed show that started in 1958, ran for 276 episodes. Paul, welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you, Stephen. Pleasure to be here, believe me.
And also, a number of years ago, I think it was 7 or 8 years ago, you were a cameo guest on one of our WGTD radio theater broadcasts when we did the new Donna Reed Show.
Well, and I love radio theater. It really is theater of the mind. And, you know, between you and me, I missed it on a professional level here in Southern California
mm-hmm.
by about 2 years. The radio theater had pretty much disappeared by the time I was working in the business.
Sure. One of the things I wanted to talk about, actually a number of things I wanted to talk with you about today in terms of the great work that you do with your foundation called A Minor Consideration that deals with kid actors, past and present, and all of that. But before we get into that, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Paul, and I know you and I have talked about it one-on-one, but what life was like for you growing up, you know, at the studio as far as your education? You were one of the, you were a Mouseketeer at age 9 or 10, I believe.
Right, 9 years old. That was the summer of 1955.
What was life like for you as a child growing up, either whether it was, you know, at the Disney Studios or when you were doing the Donna Reed Show or when you're doing movies before the Donna Reed Show in terms of your education?
Well, it was highly unusual. Understand that since 1922, California has had very good education for kids in the entertainment business. And that's important to realize because, of course, Hollywood was the center of the entertainment business. So they had long established rules. But here's the rub, Stephen. Not all states follow the California model. In fact, there are 20 states that are devoid of mandatory education. So all those things you think you know about kids in show business in many states are just not true. In California, on a school day, there is a mandatory studio teacher credentialed by the state, and given the authority to guard the health, safety, and morals of the minor. But if you're in a state like, say, North Carolina, there is no mandatory teacher. There are not mandatory limited work hours. There is no mandatory Coogan money set aside. So it's now a hodgepodge, and the entertainment business is spread all over the planet. Now, for me, especially on the Donna Reed Show, I had the same tutor for 8 years from the middle of seventh grade right through third year of college. Dr. Lillian Barkley, a tremendous woman. She was the head of Columbia's education department, and she held off her retirement because we had such a good time. So every day, at a minimum, on a school day, I had to have 3 hours of school. Now, of course, those were all solids because there was no gym, there was no wood shop, nothing like that. And the truth is, I had more fun in that schoolroom than just laying about in a dressing room.
Now, when you were in these classes, how many other child actors were there, let's say when you were in seventh grade, eighth grade, ninth grade, and so forth?
Well, it depended on what guest stars we had. If we had a couple of kids who came in, they would share the schoolroom with me. But generally, they were only in for 1 or 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Shelley Fabre and I were in the schoolroom together.
Right.
Until after high school for her. But it was a dream in terms of education of what I, if I didn't have a particularly good day or I wasn't interested very much in doing English or math, well, Dr. Barkley would switch to another subject and capture my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And the time just flew by. Better than that, though, was that the adults on the set, particularly Donna Reed and Carl Betts, cherished education. So there was never a moment when I felt like I was taking time away from my job to go to school. They made it very important, and they would they'd cut me some slack if I needed another 10 minutes to finish a test.
Sure.
Well, I got that 10 minutes.
You mentioned Carl Betts and Donna Reed. Maybe share with us what it was like working with the two of them. Obviously, Donna Reed had an incredible career, and we'll talk a bit in a few minutes about the Donna Reed Foundation and the work that you and Shelley do and Dennis in Iowa. But maybe just share some thoughts about both Carl Betts and Donna Reed.
Well, let me jump a little ahead. Let me talk about Carl Betts first. He was a classically trained Shakespearean actor who, in fact, won the Carnegie Award at Carnegie Mellon in college. He shared that award with Robert Ludlum, the novelist. He was a brilliant stage actor. So he had a real fondness for education, knew its importance, and helped enrich my life. Donna Reed was a graduate of Pasadena City College, and she had gotten that out of the way before she ever got her contract at MGM back in the day. And what made that's so important in later years is that when just before Donna passed away, she said the hardest thing she had done was to come to Los Angeles to be a star and was unprepared. And we started the foundation at her express wish to help provide Midwestern kids a solid professional grounding in the performing arts. And for many years, we provided the largest college scholarships in the performing arts in the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Donna Reed Foundation and the annual event that takes place in Denison, Iowa, I know that you and Shelley are there almost every single summer, aren't you?
Well, that's correct. It's in this environment that we're all living in here, money is tight in the world of nonprofits, as I know very well with a minor consideration as well. But nonetheless, we keep up Donna's image in her hometown of Denison, Iowa, and provide as much guidance and support as we can to young and talented people.
Let's talk about your foundation, A Minor Consideration, and maybe if you could share some thoughts about how the whole thing got started, how Rusty Hamer kind of played a role in that, and maybe start with I know the initial idea started with a book that you were working on, and then it rolled into the foundation.
Yes, I had, you know, I'd written, my 10th book was a book called Walt, Nicky, and Me, when I finally, in 1976 and 77, took a look back at my experience, not only as a Mouseketeer, but my friendship with all of the Mouseketeers, and how that early fame affected our lives. And I began to notice, this is back in 77, there were common threads. And then, some years later, I suddenly had to go to three different funerals, Tim Hovey, Trent Lehman, and most famous of all, Rusty Hamer from the Danny Thomas Show.
Mm-hmm.
This is January 1990. And I finally looked at my wife, having learned some lessons, not only in my own life, but in what I had witnessed. I said, I got to do something about this. I'm not going to have a former kid star in trouble without me showing up. And that started a minor consideration. I took a big, thick manuscript called A Minor Consideration and just pushed it off to the side of the desk. And my wife and I, Rana, and I started A Minor Consideration. We had no idea of what we were getting into. I can remember us telling Rana, well, maybe there'll be 3, 4, or 5 kids a year we can help. Well, all of a sudden, it was 60, it was 600, it was representing the professional children at the theatrical unions, both AFTRA and SAG. And before we knew it, for me particularly, it took over my life. But for my wife, it was pretty interesting because she's a show business nurse.
Mm-hmm.
She runs the medical department for CBS, the studio. To the old Republic studio.
Mm-hmm.
So she was very familiar, particularly with babies working in the industry. And right from the get-go, once we got our friends involved, we suddenly realized that there were some structural changes that had to be made, starting with this single fact, Stephen, and this bothers me as much today as it did then. Children in the entertainment business are exempt from federal child labor laws. They have been since 1938. They share this exemption, incidentally, with kids in agriculture. In any event, we started to attack bit by bit the structural problems within the entertainment industry, beginning with the hiring of premature babies. We put a stop to that in California. The rules said that a baby had to be 15 days old before they could work, but that wasn't good enough for Hollywood. They were hiring babies who were 8 and 10 weeks premature and then counting 15 days. So you got a 3-pounder on the set of ER or Chicago Hope. That was our first success. And then we started to build on that, culminating with a change in the Coogan Law, so that the kid who does the work owns the money. And that was a significant change. That was back in 2000. And that's what we're trying to do even today with the new leadership and a minor consideration, is to get the rules nationalized, in fact, international, so that everywhere a kid works, the rules will be the same, including limited hours, mandatory financial set-asides, mandatory teachers.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned AFTRA. I know that you're currently chair or past chair of the Young Performers Committee. Is that correct?
That's correct, past chair. Mm-hmm.
Right. And in that capacity, how did you mesh together, bring together your work with a minor consideration and the important role you played as chair of the Young Performers Committee?
Well, actually, it was pretty seamless, to tell you the truth, because, frankly, the concerns of young people within the entertainment industry had gone unaddressed for so long that when I and my friends started agitating within the industry, people would slap their head and say, what do you mean they're exempt from federal law? What do you mean teachers aren't mandatory? What do you mean you don't own your money? What about Coogan? And we had a lot of support within the theatrical community, including the producers and their major organizations. It was easier than I thought it would be. But this came about because of the advice Ron and I got early in the game from a very powerful man in show business who said to us, you can accomplish anything in Hollywood if you don't care who gets the credit.
I was reading what you wrote on your minor consideration site. The title is Kid Actors Past and Present. And you talked a bit about some of the advice that Mickey Rooney gave you.
Significant day in my life, that's for sure.
Yeah, what exactly did Mickey say to you?
Well, I was unemployed and unemployable a few years after the Donna Reed Show, and Mickey Rooney, who shares my birthday, came to my house unannounced and barged past me and sat down on my couch, and he said, "You listen to me. You got to get out of town, get your education, and don't come back here because they won't let you work for 25 or 30 years. And I said, "Well, why are you telling me this?" And he said, "Because it happened to me." And you got to remember, back in the day, Mickey Rooney, age 19, 20, was the biggest star in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew something, and I paid attention. And as fate would have it, within a year, I was out of Los Angeles, pursuing my education and starting my writing career with Simon & Schuster.
A few last questions. Maybe talk briefly about the television show that the series that you are working on that's called Aging in L.A. and what that's all about.
Yes, I got invited to play what it was then, a temporary host on a locally produced show called Aging in L.A. for the Department of Aging. Which is, of course, covers all the major metropolitan areas in the country. And 8 years later, and almost 200 shows, I was still doing it, and I learned so much, because another neglected segment of our community are our seniors. There are so many things we have to address, whether it's non-medical, in-home care, or that we need to build more assisted living facilities. We need more people to help, you know, trained professional staff to help take care of our seniors, because our population is so quickly aging. And it became another passion, Steve, to be blunt.
Mm-hmm.
I got very involved.
Mm-hmm. We're obviously taping this, and I'm going to be rolling into this interview just a short clip of one of your great songs that I always love to hear. It's called My Dad.
He isn't much in the eyes of the world, but he is the world to me. My dad. Now here is a man. To me, he is everything strong.
Every time you hear that song that our audience just heard a brief clip of, what kind of thoughts does that bring back in terms of the show, your own family, and your own life?
Well, it still impacts me every bit as much as the day I sang it to Carl Betts on the Donna Reed Show. You know, I've lost Carl Betts. I lost my dad, my you know, biological father, my stepdad, and my favorite father-in-law. And one day I woke up, Stephen, and realized I'm the dad. You know, I have three children, and the song is a powerful statement about the importance of fathers in our home.
Well, Paul, I really want to thank you for taking your time. You know, I know on your business card it says actor, author, and advocate. And I know that all three of those are important to you, but that third title, advocate, is incredible. And I just want to thank you for all the great things that you do, both you and Rana, and hopefully we can continue this conversation at some other time.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to pick up right where we left off, Steve. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Okay, thanks so much, Paul. I want to thank my two guests today on Education Matters, Dr. Tony Evers, our state school superintendent, and also Paul Peterson, who talked about his foundation, A Minor Consideration. For Education Matters here on WGTD HD, I'm Steve Brown.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning and welcome to WGTD-FM and this our Saturday morning program, Community Matters.